Welcome to the Wildlife Health Talks. This is the 12th episode introducing WDA members and the amazing work all over the world. For the first time, I'm taking you to South Africa. My guest today is Dr. Anna Hall. Anna is a wildlife vet in conservation and One Health at the Human-Livestock Interface based in Nisna, South Africa. Anna currently works for Conservation International and is affiliated with the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you, Kat. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. And I just thank you so much for driving this podcast. I think it's a fantastic way to, get to know WDA members and spread the word more broadly. So great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. And when did you join the WDA?
Gosh, I think I will be showing my age here a bit because I think I first joined as a student via the EWDA chapter when I was doing my veterinary degree in Edinburgh, Scotland. That's probably about 15 years ago or so now.
That means you probably have a whole lot of memories associated with the WDA. Can you tell us your favorite?
Yeah, so many memories. And I think, I've been to a few conferences and each one has been amazing. But I think probably the memories that stick the most are related to the student activities. And my first real encounter was during one of the EWDA's student mentorship programs in Greece. And it was my first time in Greece and my first time that I really immersed myself in the WDA world. And I was just sort of blown away by the camaraderie and genuine kindness and support shown by the mentors, many of whom were these amazing vets that sort of I looked up to as a student. And they were there sort of on ground level with all of our students sharing their stories and experiences. And yeah, it was just a fantastic gathering. And that's sort of where my love for One Health or planetary health was first peaked. But as I say, every WDA conference has left me with wonderful memories. And I just love the diversity of people, disciplines and topics that, make these conferences so educational and exciting. And I guess out of the conferences I've been to, the one that sticks the best or most profoundly is the one in Australia in about, I think it was 2015, where I got to present my PhD work. And I also combined it with a bit of a holiday to visit my sister who was living there. So yeah, lots of wonderful WDA memories.
That sounds awesome. And unfortunately, I haven't been to the one in Greece nor to the one in Australia, but I heard that both were really great. I was hoping the international conference this year would be in Greece again after I heard it would be in Athens, but of course it turned out to be Georgia. So that was slightly disappointing. So you have a very interesting and diverse background, and I love to learn more about it now in this interview. So you did a master's in One Health at Pretoria University, where you focus on tick-borne diseases and the human-livestock interface. And after that, you moved on to a PhD in rhino physiology at Kruger National Park. What is it that fascinates you about working with rhinos?
Sure, yeah. Rhinos are an incredible species in, I guess, so many ways. Granted, they're probably not the most intelligent of our species, but when you're up close to a rhino, I don't know, you almost feel like you have a glimpse into a prehistoric world. Everything about them, from the way they're just physique and that skin and their weird face and they've survived so much. But now, thanks to us humans, their existence is in question. So I think that's to me, what's very interesting as well is the whole escalation of the rhino poaching, which is quite sickening and sad. And so I feel particularly sad for rhino because in many ways, they're just these massive, gentle prehistoric giants and have very little to no defense against sort of human greed, really. And more from a scientific perspective, I guess what is fascinating about rhino and especially white rhinos is their physiology and the way they react to drugs, especially our immobilizing drugs. And, they're these massive animals, but interestingly, they just react so differently to opioids in many ways, and in some ways are quite sensitive, a sensitivity that sort of belies their size. So, yeah, I think there's lots of interesting things I could go on for ages about rhino, and I do love them.
And at the beginning, you mentioned a peak in poaching. I'm sure we could talk about this for hours, but can you give a very brief summary of what does that actually mean? Is this a very recent thing in only the last few years? And what is causing that peak?
Yeah, so I mean, I think poaching, you know, it's gone through phases, and as I'm sure many of you or most listeners will know, the rhino populations were at a disastrous level to sort of a handful of rhino left, probably about 50 or 60 years ago, and then managed the rhino population through conservation efforts, you know, amazing conservation efforts, managed to build that population back up. But then I guess since probably about the 2010s or so, rhino poaching then began to escalate again. And this time, you know, it was poaching, whereas I think previously the rhino population decline was a lot to do with habitat encroachment and various other factors. Whereas now I think the poaching is mostly driven from a massive demand for rhino horn. And it's just these large poaching syndicates that are involved that are very wealthy, have all sorts of resources, and are very sophisticated in the way they can infiltrate anti-poaching defense systems, and yeah, just have a lot of money to throw at trying to get rhino horn in whichever means they can, because the price for rhino horn in various areas, you know, especially sort of the growing middle class in the east and things, is huge. Rhino poaching is just satisfying the demand, which is ever increasing, I think.
After your PhD, and I haven't mentioned this before, I kept this a little bit of a secret, and I find this very exciting. So after your PhD, you pursued a MBA, a move that is rather unusual for a vet. What made you take this degree?
Yeah, you're right. It is was quite an unusual step. And to be honest, you know, pursuing an MBA was a rather chance happening. During my PhD, as I mentioned, I was faced head on with the rhino poaching crisis. And it really made me realize that I wanted to better understand these global economic forces. You know, why is there such a massive demand? And why is a dead rhino more valuable than a live rhino? And I realized that conservation cannot really be accomplished in a silo. And we need a sort of systems level approach. And we need to incorporate humans and global forces, which are all quite central to achieving the conservation outcomes that I was quite passionate about. So, when deciding on my next steps after the PhD, I just sort of randomly came across an advert for an Africa fellowship to pursue an MBA in California. And I sort of read through the application process and decided to just go ahead with the application because it was quite a sort of a process that made me think internally and push myself to really understand and make myself, you know, articulate what matters most to me and the contribution I hope to make to Africa. So I wanted to put myself through that process. And then when I was offered the fellowship, it was quite hard to say no, despite being rather apprehensive about immersing myself in this sort of capitalist world. So yeah, it wasn't something that I had thought out from day one, that just almost happened.
And what was the experience like to get your degree?
So I was definitely a significant outlier in the class, as you can imagine. But in many ways, I probably learned the most given my very low starting point. I also had the realization that the conservation world is actually quite small, and there is not enough crossover between business and conservation. So one of my best experiences during the MBA was leading a global study trip to South Africa with the theme Natural Capital. And I took about 30 students to study the importance of natural capital, including rhino. And we went to Kruger and visited some rhino orphans. And that experience made me realize that, you know, I actually had so much to offer this business world and my business class, despite having very little or zero business background. And I was not an investment banker. I was not a consultant like, you know, 90% of the rest of my class. But I still had a lot to offer, even though I felt like I was learning so much during the experience. So yeah, it really just opened my eyes to that need for more collaboration and crossover between very different disciplines.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I bet that your fellow students were super keen to hear all of your stories about your past research in South Africa and all that. So yeah, I can imagine it probably would have paid off to be a bit different in the class.
Yeah.
So you talked about how you wanted to learn more about the whole, the logistics behind it, or the whole context why a dead rhino is worth more than an alive one, I guess, in order to help you understand the issue better, but then of course also moving forward and getting more of an insight about potential new management strategies to mitigate or decrease poaching. But I'm just wondering, it just seems to me that having a live rhino is obviously amazing for the ecosystem anyway, but also for tourists being able to see the rhino in the wild and going on a safari, amazing. But on the other hand, we have people, and as you said, the Middle East or Asia, I assume as well, we have people there, few people who pay a fortune for a rhino horn. So I feel like there's a bit of a disconnect between having some value in tourists being able to see the rhino alive in its natural habitat, and then on the other hand, a huge profit that can be gained by selling that horn. It feels like, it's such a huge difference financially what a dead rhino brings. Is that kind of a frustrating thought?
No, absolutely. And you're spot on. And that's really what has driven me for a few years now, actually, is realizing that our global value system is warped, really. You know, the way that we put value and measure prosperity is wrong, or, you know, is not all encompassing. And I think I've since finishing my PhD and then going on this track of the MBA and thinking more about economics and value systems, realizing that there is a systems level problem here that we need to try and correct. And of course, you know, me being one person can't correct that, but I'm trying to understand it a bit better and bring different people together to look at our value system and try and at least champion different ways of showing growth or showing well-being. And now we are starting to look at things, you know, so GDP, gross domestic product, which is really showing consumption, you know, how countries are increasing their GDP has really been sort of how you measure progress. But there's so much missing on that. And a lot of, you know, GDP growth has been based on environmental destruction and including, you know, biodiversity destruction and killing of animals and forests and oceans. So I am, very interested and continue to push looking at alternative value systems. And I think, you know, just going back to rhino and rhino horn, I think it's, yes, we need, you know, live rhino just through tourism are not as valuable if you're just looking at it purely from a numbers perspective compared to the rhino horn that can be sold on the market in the East or wherever they're fetching these massive prices. But I think if globally we took a more holistic approach to valuing ecosystems and ecosystem services, so the whole biodiversity of the habitat where rhino live and those ecosystem services from providing fresh air and fresh water and carbon sequestration and, you know, ensuring proper biodiverse, well-functioning ecosystem services. If we really truly valued those properly in terms of what they bring to global human health, we probably would be closer to the value of a dead rhino, as it were, if you look at in those perspectives. So yeah, I think there's a lot to be done in terms of shifting how the world values nature and ecosystem services. And I'm pleased to say there are, you know, small pockets where we are starting to look at things like the well-being economy or pinning a monetary value on ecosystem services. And some governments are starting to adopt these sort of, you know, natural capital accounts. But I still think we have obviously a long way to go, but it's definitely something I'm passionate about and hope to continue to pursue.
Nice. Yeah, that's a really nice outlook. I love that. Currently, you're based in South Africa again, and you work for an organization called Conservation International. What does the organization actually stand for?
Yeah, so Conservation International, it's the conservation non-profit or NGO, and it really stands for sort of the intersection of people and nature. So nature doesn't need people, but people need nature. And as the name suggests, Conservation International works around the globe to protect nature. And we use sort of science, policy, and partnerships to conserve important ecosystem services that provide food and water and sustain economies and regulate the climate. So it really works, it's that intersection of sort of using economics and economic forces for good in terms of nature conservation. So by creating novel conservation funding models and production models to try and better balance the demand with protection of essential natural resources.
One of the projects you're currently working in is called Herding for Health. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What's the background? What is this project all about?
Yes, exactly. So I, in Conservation International, I am the Africa Rangelands Program Manager, and the main program I manage is Herding for Health. And Herding for Health is essentially a One Health or planetary health program that works with pastoralist farmers to better manage livestock at the livestock-wildlife interface. And so we provide these pastoralist farmers with skills. We put them through a course for skilled herders so that they can better manage livestock, often communally, to regenerate rangelands and improve biodiversity, as well as improving human health and the health of livestock. And we, you know, also, so we combine sort of traditional knowledge in terms of how traditionally these pastoralist farmers used to move their livestock across large tracts of land, leaving areas to rest for a good amount of time so that the land could regenerate. And we also combine it with sort of up-to-date science and technology where we can, so technology for monitoring, improved monitoring, as well as quite novel mobile predator-proof bomas or kraals. So these animals can be protected at night against predators and also strategically moved using these kraals across the landscape to use their dung and hoof movements to regenerate the rangelands rather than degrade them.
How is the process going of working with the local farmers and make them, yeah, maybe even a bit passionate about helping them, but at the same time helping wildlife? Like, is that a big step of explaining them or showing them why there's a value to the wildlife, or is that a natural thing they're aware of anyway?
Yeah, great question. And I think, you know, historically, conservation has not actually gone about working with local farmers in the right way. And so there is almost an inherent antipathy towards conservation, and local farmers, you know, don't value or like wildlife or like sort of the conservation notion, really, because they've traditionally been pushed to the periphery and not given the sort of rights or value that they deserve from sort of just being on the land and their past protection of the land and stewardship of the land. So initially there can be some sort of antagonism, but we with Herding for Health really come in not as a conservation program, but rather as a sort of livelihood program with conservation outputs. And when you describe it and really listen to the local farmers and understand their you know, their real concerns and their real struggles in terms of climate change. You know, they're seeing more drought and it's harder to keep their livestock healthy and the land is degrading and they don't have enough grazing. So when you come with an approach that can show them that with a biodiverse, healthy ecosystem, it can become a win-win situation where, you know, the land is restored and they can also diversify economies, get, you know, with ecosystem services, including tourism and wildlife, but also livestock, as long as the ecosystem services are well protected and managed sustainably, you know, they can really farm for generations into the future. So I think once once you explain that we're really there to improve livelihoods, they are very receptive. Generally, the local farmers are very receptive and are keen to try new ways, because I think currently it's quite obvious that a lot of the lands are degraded and they, you know, they can, won't be able to sustain livelihoods for generations if the trends continue as they are.
That sounds like an awesome project for sure. Is this project supported by the government, or how does the organization fund it?
Yeah, we get funding from various streams. There's some private donors. And then also, you know, we apply for large grants from multinationals or government agencies from various governments. So yeah, a bit of a mix.
You also collaborate with researchers from a university in Johannesburg, where you took over the role as wildlife anesthesiologist for multiple research projects. Please tell us a bit more about your adventures in this role. Like, what kind of projects have you been involved in there?
Yes, so I'm still affiliated with the group through which I did my PhD called Wildlife Conservation Physiology at the University of Witwatersrand. And this group is led by Professor Andrea Fuller. And a lot of the research this group does is centered around better understanding how large mammals are able to cope and adapt to a changing climate. And so with the hope, you know, that our results could then inform management decisions to help better conserve these mammals. So we observe wild animals and how they are physiologically adapting to a changing climate by measuring physiological variables with biologgers, so that we can take out the variable of human observation. You know, we can look at physiology without having to have a human present. And I was very lucky to be involved in working with a number of very special and unique species while helping this group. So, you know, we worked with aardvark and pangolin, and I did a big lion project as well. And so, yeah, I've had some very memorable moments throughout Southern Africa working with this group and just sort of providing some veterinary input to help make sure that the loggers are placed ethically and well in these animals, so that we can improve how we manage these animals as climate change impacts habitats.
One of the species you have worked with in that larger climate change project is the aardvark, as you mentioned. And maybe not everyone from our audience is familiar with this species. I've only seen it in zoos a couple of times, and I'm quite intrigued. It's quite a special mammal in many ways. Could you give us a brief summary of what this animal is like and what makes it special, apart from its interesting looks, I guess?
Yes, aardvark are very interesting. So it's sort of like a very strong pig-like creature with a long snout and very long tongue and weird sort of claw-like nails that it uses for digging, because it lives in burrows under the ground. And they have actually beautiful eyes with beautiful eyelashes. So they're nocturnal and they dig these burrows, live underground. And we think that's also to help with sort of thermoregulation, because they live in some areas sort of semi-desert where it can get very hot during the day and very cold at night. So these burrows sort of help with keeping a sort of stabilized temperature, and especially during the day, they don't get too hot. And then they come out at night and forage on termites, and they're quite selective with their diet, actually. So during, you know, very hot and dry spells, we actually saw that a lot of aardvark weren't doing so well. We're actually dying and coming out earlier during the day to forage for a longer period, because their prey were digging deeper and it was harder for these aardvark to feed themselves and find the prey. So yeah, very interesting species with quite a select diet, which, you know, is quite a worry if their prey do start disappearing as climate gets hotter and drier.
About how many termites does an aardvark has to eat per night to fulfill its calories requirement?
Very good question. I'll have to go back and check that out. I'm not sure if we've actually totally discovered that, but it's amazing how strong and muscular they can get on a diet of, yeah, termites and ants and things. So it is incredible, and I'm afraid I don't have the answer, but I'll push that. I'm sure probably someone in your audience has an answer for us.
That sounds good.
Best guess.
No worries at all. And you have done some field work on the aardvarks, and you have a Quite an interesting story there. Do you want to share the story of how you, tried to get a temperature logger bag from an aardvark, which was harder than expected?
Sure. I mean, as you can imagine, darting a species that is nocturnal and lives underground is not the easiest of tasks for a wildlife vet. And, you know, initially to implant the loggers, we actually were quite successful because before we even knew much about their physiology and their way of life, we noticed that they were coming out during the day, so we could dart quite a few in daylight before it got dark, which was great and relatively easy, and we only later discovered that they were actually coming out earlier because they were sort of physiologically compromised. So then, you know, a year later when we had to retrieve these loggers from the same aardvark, and it was actually a much better year, there had been more rain and the aardvark were physiologically more stable. So they were only coming out much later at night, but we had to get these loggers back. So I remember sitting outside one burrow, you know, we set up, I was sitting on a chair waiting, and I had to be absolutely silent because they have very good ears. They can hear their termites, you know, that's how they can get their prey. So being absolutely silent for hours, waiting for this aardvark to emerge from its burrow to go foraging so that I could then dart it and we could retrieve the logger. And it was starting to get quite cold in the Kalahari nights, but I was so determined to try and get this aardvark, and we had tried a few nights before and been unsuccessful, but we were pretty sure we'd be successful now. We knew where the animal was. We were sitting waiting and had some amazing sights there. You know, you have the jackal calling right next to you, and also an African wildcat caught a mouse just a few meters away from me. So a special experience. And then I was really excited to get this aardvark, and we started hearing some noises coming from the burrow. So I knew that, you know, it was maybe waking up and coming out of the burrow. I was super excited, waiting there, dart gun poised, got the pressure right, got everything sorted. And eventually, you know, the sound got louder and it started, you could hear the sand scratching away. And out came what I thought was going to be the aardvark, but it was actually a porcupine. So my heart just sank because I was about to dart a porcupine. The porcupine came out, and what was amazing is the porcupine came right up to me and started sort of challenging me, reversing into me, stamping its foot. I didn't move. And I think because I didn't move, it eventually sort of walked away. But it was fascinating. I've never been challenged by a porcupine. And then, you know, more sound came out of the burrow. So I was like, yay, okay, this is finally the aardvark is coming out. And again, what came out was a porcupine. So I was very much disappointed in these porcupine that were obviously living in the sort of mouth of the burrow. And again, this porcupine came and challenged me, which, yeah, I must say, I don't think many people have been challenged by a porcupine. But I can tell you, if you just sit absolutely still, they won't do anything to you. They just try and reverse and stamp their foot and try reverse into you. But if you don't challenge them, then they eventually walk off.
Is it true? Is it true that they can actually shoot their quills?
I don't think so. Well, if they can, then this one did. These two didn't want to shoot their quills because they didn't shoot at me, which I'm quite pleased about.
That's lucky.
I'm pleased that they can't or don't, at least voluntarily.
And did the aardvark finally show itself?
So it finally showed itself, and of course, by the time it came, I tracked it a bit and was super dark, and I had a torch, but took a shot and actually missed, I'm afraid. So that night we were unsuccessful. I was unsuccessful. I think I was so annoyed by the porcupine as well. I think that's what a lot of wildlife veterinary is like, you know, a lot of hurry up and wait and sit and wait and wait and wait for the opportunity. The opportunity comes, it passes, you miss, oh dear. But yeah, we managed to go out another night and we did eventually get that aardvark. But yeah, lots of time waiting, but special times as well. I had some amazing sightings in those Kalahari nights.
Thanks so much for being my guest on the show, Anna.
Sure, absolutely, Cass. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Wildlife Health Talks. We will be back with a new story in 2 weeks. Bye for now.